Thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. We are live Saturdays, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, from Studio M in Los Angeles. I am Stephen Spear, and this is TalkRadio1.com for Saturday, the 18th day of June 2022. My email address, steve@talkradio1.com, steve@talkradioone.com. I know that there are a lot of places that we can all get information about inflation and recession and the economy and the real estate market. But today I want to offer my personal perspective and try to draw together and make sense of the cacophony of information to which we are all subjected on a daily basis. There are some simple rules that actually govern our complicated economy, and it's hard, at least I find it hard, to derive a clear understanding of what's going on from the way that the news is reported, either by legacy media or by social media, and even from much of the analytical commentary that is supposedly objective. So it's tainted. And right now I'm going to offer my view of it all, and your comments are certainly welcome. Let's start with what causes the confusion. There's plenty of confusion, and it comes from the press and the legacy media and social media and the new media, all of it, because we have conflicting reports and numbers without explanation and numbers out of context, incorrect assumptions about what causes things. Like you'll hear regularly as a stock market report is done by financial reporters. By financial reporters, they'll say the stock market plunged today on news of this. And they could say it's interest rates or it's Putin in the Ukraine or it's something the White House said or something the White House didn't say. And you hear them say that, and that's not what happened in the stock market today. What happened in the stock market on any day is the result of tens of millions of decisions made by, many times by individual stockholders who buy or sell stocks in particular companies, and then the Dow or the S&P 500 report on some of those companies, but certainly not all of them. And they are decisions made by computers and decisions made by large investors that influence the market and then counter moves by other investors. So when someone says, yeah, that's what it is, it's a result of the market doing this or the market doing of news doing this, it's not accurate. Some of the media even have a bias. It's conscious or it's unconscious. And worse than that, some have an actual agenda. So they are distorting intentionally to create a response and feelings for political purposes or social purposes or other purposes. Then we have the White House and the Federal Reserve Board, as well as various elected officials at all levels, and they're part of the problem. So we started by hearing from the White House and the Fed that there's no inflation. Then they said, no, there is inflation, but it's transitory. Then they said, well, it's going on longer than we thought, but it's not bad. This inflation is not bad. And then they said, it's bad, but it's due to Putin. It's the Putin price increase. And then they said, inflation really is a problem, but it's because of greed. And then now they're saying we're in a transitional economy. It's just transitional. And what they mean by that is transitional out of COVID as a result of the government lockdowns. And then they said, but it won't result in a recession. And now they're saying it might result in a recession, but it won't be deep and it won't be a big problem. And then they say they're doing everything they can. And then you hear nothing specific because really, there is nothing specific that the White House can do. There are things that it's done. There are things that it could do going forward. But specifically something we're really focusing on really solving this inflation problem, it misleads. It causes people to feel like either they believe it and the government is going to do something, so they wait, or they don't believe it and they make moves instead. So none of that helps. And that's on the Democratic side. Then you have the Republican opposition who says it's all Biden's fault. It's all the Democrats' fault. It's the Democratic-led Congress's fault for passing, for spending all this money. And they insist that the White House should do something. So again, none of that helps. So that's why today I'm going to try to contextualize it. The first thing that I see frequently is one-factor analysis. And whenever there's one-factor analysis, it's wrong. It's wrong. It's just going to be wrong because it's really integrated. Every piece of the economy is integrated to every other piece of the economy. There's connective tissue between every single aspect. There's almost nothing that operates independently. And this one factor analysis, we hear it's the Putin price hike, or that's on the from the president. From the right, we hear it's government spending. And then you'll hear people debate whether it is one or the other, and it's not. Of course, it's both. It's both plus more. It includes the rebound from the COVID shutdown, and there is some greed, and there is some fear, and there's the Democratic agenda, and then there's the Republican agenda, and then the agenda of big business, and the agenda of the oil-producing nations and the oil barons, and the agenda of each individual in their lives, and all of this goes into the mix. And you can have an argument, but it's not very important to have the argument as to which factor matters the most, because they all matter. What matters is what are all the factors and how do all these things contribute? And this is the same thing. This one factor analysis is the same thing that gives rise to the one issue voter. There are voters, not actually as many as the press would have you believe, but there are one issue voters who will vote based only upon one issue. So for some people, it's guns, one way or the other, abortion, immigration. Now we will see a whole bunch of voters who will vote on inflation in November, issues of taxing the rich, because someone has convinced them that if you tax the rich, somehow that money will help the poor. It won't just go into the government and disappear. And some people, not as many as should, take foreign policy as a top number. So when you hear that's, oh, and the January 6th hearings, there's another factor. There are some people who will vote exclusively based on that. Again, it motivates Democrats, it motivates Republicans. And the one issue voters and the one factor analysis all tend to confuse the issue. It polarizes people and it prevents a really solid integrated analysis. So then you have the problem of one issue experts. And so a one issue expert is not really an expert. So for example, the Federal Reserve, their entire agenda forever has been interest rates and the unemployment rate. And because the Federal Reserve focused only on interest rates and unemployment rates, and therefore inflation, the combination of those, they missed an opportunity and sacrificed most of the tools they would have had to combat inflation easily when it was not as much of a problem, or to make it less deep or severe than it might be. All of that's gone. Now they only have the blunt instrument of severe interest rate rises. So what happened is the Federal Reserve considered only interest rates and unemployment and their effect on inflation, and now they've lost control. This is the same problem we had during COVID, where the CDC and the National Institutes of Health and the Surgeon General, they focused only on COVID deaths. Dr. Fauci focused only on COVID deaths, COVID safety. And you'd say, well, of course he did. We don't want people to die. But what the president, Trump or Biden, have to do when you get information from Dr. Fauci or from the CDC and you get this information is you have to weigh it as a factor. Again, I'm talking about one factor analysis is always wrong. And where any president says the only issue here is health because my expert in health is telling me this and this is a health issue, ignores and fails to take into account what's going to happen next. So the economy, the effect on mental health, the effect on social interaction, the effect on children education, the effect on high school seniors graduating or college graduates coming out into the world, the effect on the job market. So a good president would take into account all of those factors, not just the health aspect. Got to make the health aspect pretty important, but would take all those into account. That's hard to do, but that's the job of the president. An example I can give you is, as you know, I'm a real estate and business attorney. I've been practicing for 45 years. When a client comes to me with a legal problem, if I just opine on the legal problem, I'm not really helping the client because it has to factor in. Everything has to factor in. I had just yesterday a client who has a claim being made against her for a great deal of money that she did nothing wrong, and she's wondering, should I pay? Because if she doesn't pay, a client of hers will be sued, a customer of hers will be sued, and that will hurt her business. So she's going to negotiate and pay money herself that legally she shouldn't have to pay. By the way, morally and ethically, she shouldn't have to pay, but she's going to pay it after a long conversation that we had where she properly concluded that in spite of having a complete legal right, that would be one factor analysis, to say, no, I'm not paying any of it. If she did, it would hurt her business much more than the great deal of money she's going to pay to solve the problem. So if I had just done a one-factor analysis, my answer as just a lawyer, if I were just a lawyer, would be, yes, you can make that claim. You can get that money. You don't have to pay it. You can make them pay it. And it would have cost her much more. So one-factor analysis is never right. So what you're left with instead of one-factor analysis is considering everything. And the collective knowledge of the world is much more reliable than any expert or group of experts. And so as a result, if you look at what the world tells you when inflation is happening or when interest rates are very low and people respond to that by borrowing a great deal of money, or where money is easy to get so unqualified borrowers borrow it, or whenever you see the collective knowledge of the world, that's the one you've got to watch. And it's hard to watch because it isn't reported well in the press. And giving the devil their due, it's hard to report that correctly. But what we talk about the undermining of institutions and the undermining of faith in experts is bad. Yes, it's bad, but sometimes it's actually good to the extent that you do this. You say, yes, this expert, this deep expert on health or on interest rates or on law, this deep expert has deep expertise in that. I need to take that deep expertise seriously, and I need to weigh in all the other factors. Because you have across the country now, reacting to inflation, causing inflation, causing price raises, causing wage rises, which cause price rises, which cause wage rises. You have tens of millions of people making hundreds of millions of decisions on a daily, hourly, minute-by-minute basis. And the collective knowledge of the world is more reliable than any expert or group of experts, so we have to look at that big picture. So to predict what's going to happen, we have to predict what hundreds of millions of people are going to decide. And that sounds really hard. It's not as hard as it sounds, but the press and the government can't seem to do it right, because when they're making predictions, the government and the press have different incentives. The people in the government, we don't have a Washington, Hamilton, Jefferson, Franklin among them, it doesn't seem right now, want to keep power and gather more power. That seems to be a problem now, that many of our public elected officials are not courageous. They are not making hard decisions and telling the hard-to-tell truth. And then the press, who wants to gather and keep and add more viewers and listeners and eyeballs, they have a perverse incentive as well. And so when you're going to look, if you and I just want answers and we want to know what to actually expect, because we have decisions to make. We need to decide to buy or sell stock, to buy our house or sell a house, to retire or to keep working. all of us have individual decisions to make. Can we afford to go on that vacation? Can we, should we cut back? Should we spend? Should we invest? Should we save? Do we have too much in savings? And now it's being eroded by inflation. Should we put it somewhere else? And so forth. Should we ask for a raise? Should we change jobs? Should we, if we can't get a raise here, should we stay put? All of those questions have to be made. So then you look and you say, all right, what is happening? And we'll go to an expert. The recession is coming, says 60% of over 750 chief executive officers in a Wall Street Journal ad, Wall Street Journal poll, a survey done with the Conference Board, which is a business research firm. They 60% of these 750 CEOs say we're headed into a recession. In January of 2021, a year and a half ago, it was 22%. Now it's 60%. Now you look at these CEOs, these 750 CEOs, and they are watching a lot of information. Some of it's from the press, but a lot of it is within their own companies. So I consider that to be more reliable. That's an important number, that from 22% who thought we're headed into a recession, now 60% think we do. So there's a drawback in the spending that we're seeing. People are cutting back already on spending. We can see that from the statistics. Home prices are still climbing. More on that in a few minutes. Interest rates are higher. Money is tighter. Homes are sitting on the market longer. More on that in a few minutes. I'm going to do a whole piece here on real estate. Groceries are higher. Gasoline's more expensive. We can all see that. So let me introduce to you The Economist. It is a British news magazine that I've subscribed to now for, gosh, I think over 20 years, maybe longer. And it, oh yeah, no, you know what? Closer to 30 years. And it's not got a strong bent to the right or the left. I've seen them in the same article praise and condemn President Biden, President Trump, President Obama, all the way back to President Reagan in the same article. They'll say the president got this right, the president got that wrong. And so I like it because if they have any bent, it's toward the economy. That's where their bias is what's going to make sense. And they integrate, as I do, the economic benefit with the human benefit that all has to go in a multifactorial analysis. And so when I look at The Economist, I'm looking at the June 4, 2022 edition in an article called America's Next Recession, the World Economy. And the subheadline is A Downturn Looks Likely. It stands to be mild but messy. So I'm going to spend a few minutes going through this in part and commenting. So the article says, not long ago, recessions seemed to strike America roughly once a decade. But only 2 years after the first lockdowns, the business cycle is turning at a sickening speed, and another one already seems to be on its way. If you are like most people, your memory of downturns will be dominated by the past two. The financial heart attack in 2007 through 9 and the pandemic-induced collapse in 2020. Both were severe and highly unusual. By their standards, America's next recession will almost certainly be milder and more pedestrian. But because the world economy, asset markets, and America's politics are all fragile, it may yet have nasty and unpredictable consequences. All right, so The Economist says we're going to have a recession. I believe we're going to have a recession. It is inevitable. The White House just this week, Karine Jean-Pierre, the White House press secretary, said it is not inevitable, and went on to explain why, and I had trouble following the reasoning. I did more reading about it. I believe we are going to have a recession. Now, what does that mean? The technical definition is two consecutive quarters of economic decline, economic contraction. Okay, we've already had one quarter January, February, March of this year, 2022. And we're in the second quarter, and I'm guessing that second quarter, which is going to end in 12 days when that report comes out sometime in July, it's going to show we had a second quarter. So technically, we'll be in a recession. I think it's more severe than just that, but we're going to have a recession. It's inevitable, I believe, because it's too late to bring inflation down to a soft landing. The Fed, the Federal Reserve Board, waited too long, and so the only tool left is serious interest rate hikes. Business decision makers and consumers are going to make millions of decisions in response. You have millions, tens of millions of people making hundreds of millions of decisions. It's not just business decision makers, it's consumers. Do I take that vacation? Do I buy that new car? Do I hold off? Do I keep this cash in the bank or do I put it somewhere? If so, is the stock market fallen enough that I should buy or is it going to fall further? Am I going to miss a buying opportunity or am I actually catching a falling knife? And so all of that is uncertain. Now I want to move to another piece. This is the Kiplinger letter. I've had Knight Kiplinger on this show before and will again soon. These are forecasts for executives and investors. It's a newsletter, a subscription newsletter that my father started taking in the 1950s. Knight Kiplinger, who is now the publisher of this newsletter, is the grandson of the fellow who started it, and Knight himself is in his late 60s or early 70s. And so this is an old line paper. I have been subscribing to it since the early 1980s. And here's what the Kiplinger letter said, June 9, 2022. Energy prices are soaring. Now, we're going to focus on energy here for a second. Energy prices are soaring, as you know, and there is just no relief in sight. Prices figure to stay painfully high for now or rise more unless a recession comes along to crimp demand. So again, if the recession comes along, that will slow prices, but that will also slow growth, and that will result in job losses and more layoffs. We've already begun to see layoffs. Continuing with Kiplinger, gas and diesel prices still haven't peaked. Unfortunately, the national average of regular unleaded already $4.97 per gallon. Remember, this was now 10 days ago. It's over five now. Is bound to rise at least a bit more. Heavy demand this summer plus inadequate supply leads naturally to higher prices. How much higher? $5.25 a gallon to $5.50 a gallon seems likely. And that is if oil prices remain fairly stable. If the oil prices surge higher, or if, for example, a hurricane hits the Gulf of Mexico and shuts down refineries, a $6 average for gas would be in play. A similar outlook for diesel, now averaging $5.74, brutal for freight shipping. So if diesel goes up, freight shipping goes up, all of our prices go up on anything that's shipped. And of course, everything is shipped, all physical goods, whether you order it from Amazon or you buy it somewhere, it's got to get there on a train or a plane or a truck. So as these prices go up and jet fuel is right there with them, all the other prices go up. Kiplinger goes on in another section in the same letter to say, you might wonder why high prices aren't encouraging more energy output. There are many reasons. The war in Ukraine, supply chain distributions, etc. Because again, supply and demand is like the law of gravity for economics. If you have more supply to meet demand, prices come down. If you don't have enough supply, prices go up. The very definition of inflation is too many dollars chasing too few products or services. So prices go up. Kiplinger continues, but a major reason why high prices are not encouraging more energy output boils down to public policies, both in the United States and abroad. The White House is discouraging oil and gas drilling and implementing regulations that will make building things like pipelines harder to do. Europe is trying to switch to renewable energy. Environmentally minded investors are pushing Wall Street not to invest in new fossil fuel production, limiting capital for oil and gas. Meanwhile, new crude oil refining capacity is badly needed, but refiners are not building it. Now, you'd say, where's the greed? Why don't they build more refineries? They could refine more oil into gasoline. They could get more money. Where's the greed? Because there are many who say this is just greed-driven. Well, if it were, you'd build more to make more money, but here's why. Kiplinger continues. Too risky. If the plants won't be able to operate for the long term to recoup costs. In fact, refiners are closing older facilities instead of upgrading them. That means their remaining plants are highly profitable now, profits are way up, but not able to meet all demands. So what happens when public policy says we're going to eliminate oil? The people who recover oil from the ground and who refine it into gasoline say, gee, I don't know if I want to invest a bunch of money in something that someone is trying to shut down. This is the same thing when a real estate developer hears that rent control is coming in. This is the same thing when anyone who's running any kind of a business hears there's going to be a regulation that's going to make things more expensive. There's going to be something that's going to make it more difficult. So taxes, regulations, fees, interference, all of those things. Now, I am not for letting everybody do anything. I'm very much for regulating business, big business in particular, not so much small business. But I am very interested in seeing people held to higher standards. That's great. But it requires a light touch. It requires something more delicate than a ham-handed, we're just going to wipe out the oil industry. Because when you send the signal that we're just going to wipe out the oil industry, it shifts the incentives for the people who are in it, and then you have higher prices. Take another angle of this, which is the Ukraine war. The American people said in poll after poll that overwhelmingly they oppose Putin going into Ukraine. Overwhelmingly, they support Ukraine and Zelensky. Overwhelmingly, while nobody wants to go to a nuclear war, overwhelmingly the call was to help Ukraine. And then when that contributes to higher gasoline prices, all of a sudden now the question is, well, maybe we shouldn't help Ukraine. And you see those poll numbers change. So if there's no overriding principled position with respect to Ukraine, then the position on Ukraine just gets you higher gas prices, to which you then react, and then you lose both Ukraine and you still have high gas prices. So if there's nothing principled in what is happening in the decisions that are being made, then the result is that policy changes constantly. It blows in the wind because, again, there are too many politicians who are just interested in being elected and reelected. Kiplinger continues, note some recent White House moves to support the United States solar industry. Most important is a 2-year suspension of any anti-circumvention tariffs on solar panels that would result from an ongoing Department of Commerce investigation. Just the threat of these duties, which could be applied retroactively, has resulted in the delay and or cancellation of hundreds of utility-scale solar projects in the United States. Well, I have solar on my house. I'm a big believer in people using solar power in areas where there's enough sun to do it. It saves a great deal of money. It saves the environment. It's a very good idea. When you have tariffs, when you have taxes, when you have regulations, it's going to stop these projects. And when you cancel hundreds of utility-scale solar projects in the United States because the government is doing investigations that scare the living KPOC out of everyone, then don't be surprised when people invest less in that. If you want less of something, raise the price. And one way you raise the price is by raising the price, but another way is with threats, with investigations, with all sorts of things that end up usually adding up to nothing. So let's go back to The Economist for a moment. And let's see. Give me a moment. Okay, here we are. There is no escaping the squeeze ahead for the American economy. So they agree with me. We're not going to get out of this. There's going to be a squeeze. There's going to be a recession. Surging food and petrol prices, petrol, because remember, it's British. It's published in London. Surging food and petrol prices are eating into people's spending. In April, consumer prices were 8.3% higher than a year earlier. All right, so this is from the June 4 edition. Today is June 18. So here's what happened. In March, the consumer prices went up 8.5%. In April, 8.3%. And again, the White House, Jen Psaki, the former White House press secretary, and Karine Jean-Pierre, the current one, both said at various times that this is a big relief. Inflation is headed down because it dropped from 8.5 to 8.3. Then in May, it went to 8.6. And the explanation was this is a temporary spike, but we're on our way to getting things under control. Even excluding food and energy prices, annual inflation is 6.2%. So when a lot of folks will say, well, if you put food and energy, those are, you know, the grocery store and the gasoline, those are the highest, they're the most visible, take them out, there's no problem. Well, there is a problem. It's still 6.2% inflation on everything, including durable goods, things you don't buy very often like refrigerators and cars, including everything, including construction, every aspect, light bulbs, everything. Supply chain problems could flare up for as long as war rages in Ukraine and as long as China sticks to its zero COVID policy. So see what China is doing to have a zero COVID policy, which is absurd and it won't work and it's not working, but there is a huge price to it. The result has ripples everywhere across the world. The American labor market is red hot with nearly two job openings for every unemployed worker in March. Two job openings for every unemployed worker in March. The most since 1950, when the data were first collected. A measure of wage growth by Goldman Sachs is at an all-time high of nearly 5.5%. So that's wage growth. So wages go up. How does an employer pay those wages? They raise their prices. When you raise the prices, that wage increase, that salary increase, didn't make any difference, so you need another one. That's the upward vicious cycle of inflation, of wage and price hikes. So Goldman Sachs says that wage growth is at 5.5, an all-time high, a rate companies cannot bear unless they continue to raise prices fast. The Federal Reserve Board is promising to pour water on the fire. Investors expect it to have raised interest rates by more than 2.5 percentage points by the end of 2022. You heard it here first. I'm saying 3% total. It's already up 1.5. And it's only June. The central bank is crossing its fingers, saying that it can hit its 2% inflation target without causing a downturn. This is what the Fed said 12 days ago. They still are saying it. They are wrong. They can't get back to 2% without much more serious increases. But history, back to The Economist, but history suggests that by acting to tame inflation, it will cause the economy to shrink. Since 1955, interest rates have risen as fast as they will this year during 7 economic cycles. In 6 of the 7 economic cycles, recession followed within 18 months. The exception was in the mid-1990s when inflation was low, which it's not, and the labor market was more balanced, which it isn't. On June 1st, Jamie Dimon, the boss of J.P. Morgan Chase, America's largest bank, warned of an approaching economic hurricane. Now, that made news because Jamie Dimon's been a pretty good predictor on a lot of different things, and so it was covered on all major media, talked about him saying there's a hurricane coming. In fact, though a recession is likely, it should be a relatively shallow one, the economist says. In the crisis of 2007 through 9, the financial system froze, and in 2020, activity in entire sectors ground to a halt. Both downturns saw the sharpest initial drops in GDP since the Second World War. This time will surely be different. In some ways, America is resilient. Consumers are still flush with cash from the pandemic stimulus, and companies have been enjoying bumper profits. The housing market is slowing as rates rise in contrast to the late 2000s. So let me deviate here and go back to Kiplinger and read a paragraph they have on this subject, housing. Higher rates have yet to meaningfully slow residential construction. Case in point, the solid readings for activity in March and April of this year, rates for the 30-year fixed-rate mortgages have risen by 2 percentage points since December. All right, so this is the Kiplinger letter, remember, from June 9, which is already 9 days ago. Things have changed. I'll get to that in a minute. They're starting to ding housing demand. Indeed, mortgage applications recently hit their lowest level since 2018, with higher rates spooking some buyers. And I can tell you from my real estate and business law practice and from our investment business, I can tell you that what I hear from clients and investors is that they are very nervous, and some people have called off sales of things they were going to buy, houses, investment properties, stock purchases, companies, expanding companies, they're calling them off. Now, that creates fewer jobs. It loses some existing jobs. This is where the cycle goes. And these are business decision makers. As I said, tens of millions of people making hundreds of millions of decisions. Back to Kiplinger. The bigger issue, shortages of building materials and skilled labor have made it harder for builders to start new projects. Despite the recent pullback in lumber prices, the overall cost of building materials is up 19% year over year and up 35% since the start of the pandemic. Meanwhile, the number of open jobs in the construction sector averages 300,000 to 400,000 per month. Home builders likely need at least 2.2 million new hires through 2024 to keep up with demand. See that. The number of open jobs, 300,000 to 400,000 per month, but home builders need at least 2.2 million new hires between now and 24 to keep up with demand. My son is an architect, a licensed architect with 13 full-time architects working for him. My son-in-law is a licensed contractor who builds new homes and does major remodels. Both of them are commenting on how everything is changing in terms of pricing and in terms of the very availability of labor to do the work that needs to be done. It's hard to find architects for Joe. It's hard to find the skilled craftspeople and subcontractors for Ben, the contractor. It is difficult and getting harder, not easier. So that's a beginning of housing. I want to go now to a Wall Street Journal article. This is the Wall Street Journal from 2 days ago, Orla McCaffrey reporting. The headline, mortgage rates hit 5.78%, highest level since 2008. So some of you have gotten home loans for rates, crazy rates, 2.4% fixed for 30 years, 2.8, 3 point low, and 5.78. Subtitle, Fed's moves to raise rates and wind down its purchases of mortgage-backed securities push up mortgage rates. Again, this is the Wall Street Journal from 2 days ago. Despite forecasts for a cooling housing market in 2022, U.S. home prices are still hitting record highs, even with mortgage rates surging in recent months. Wall Street Journal's Dion Rebouin explains what's driving demand, evidence of a slowdown is on the horizon, and what it could mean for the economy. United States mortgage rates reached their highest level in more than 13 years, the latest sign of market tumult tied to the Federal Reserve's campaign to cool inflation. The average rate on a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage rose to 5.78 mortgage finance giant Freddie Mac said Thursday, the highest level since November 2008 and well above the 3.11 record near the end of last year. Last week, Freddie Mac reported an average mortgage rate of 5.23%. Now, when the Fed was going to raise rates and they went up a quarter point, I said this on this show, there is no way that's going to do anything. And it didn't. Inflation got worse. And then they raised it a half a point, and I said there's no way. Just this now in June, they raised it 0.75 point, and they're indicating that next month, July, they may raise it another 0.75 point. Twice nothing is still nothing. It's not going to do it. It's not going to do it. We had much higher rates. I'll talk more about that in a minute, to bring inflation down 40 years ago in the 1980s, Paul Volcker as chairman of the Federal Reserve. Wall Street Journal, the surge marks the largest weekly increase since 1987. It stands to add the pressure on U.S. home prices, which remains strong despite rising rates and tumbling affordability. Well, this doesn't get explained in this article or most anywhere else. Why are the prices on United States homes going up if all this is happening with interest rates? And the answer is because of supply and demand, the law of gravity of economics. You have so few people who are selling houses. So few people are willing to sell their houses that you have more buyers demand than you have supply houses. So prices keep going up. And who gets priced out? The people who can't afford the higher rates. So this means houses go much more to cash buyers or people with substantial down, 50% down payments, where interest rates are less important. So the wealthy, again, are fine. The middle class is the one who gets, what's the technical word I'm looking for? Hosed. And that's the problem. Wall Street Journal, the Fed has been raising its benchmark interest rate to try to curb inflation and cool the housing market and the broader economy, but it's a delicate dance. No one knows for sure what the impact from higher rates will be, but some investors worry that the Fed could tip the United States into a recession. On Wednesday, the central bank raised interest rates 0.75%, the biggest rate raised since 1994. The reason these dates that I keep emphasizing, 94 and 80 and the 1950s and so forth, is because we are in an economy that practically no one who is an adult today is going to remember. I'm 69 years old. And I don't remember what happened in 1950. I barely remember what happened in the 60s when I became somewhat aware. But most of the people now have no experience with this. And so if we don't all become students of history, we risk making unnecessary mistakes. Wall Street Journal, mortgage rates don't move automatically when the Fed raises rates, but they are heavily influenced by it. The short-term rate that the Fed directly controls has risen by 1.5 percentage points this year. The average mortgage rate has risen nearly 2.7 percentage rates. So the Fed went up 1.5, mortgage rates went up 2.7. See that? This is what we're in for, and we're going to see these rates go higher. Now, real estate for sale below 6% interest, I know that sounds high to some based on the last 15, 20 years, but that's a historically relatively low interest rate. I remember that my law and business partner, John Woodward, and I bought properties with investors back in the 1980s, and we were paying 9, 10% interest. And that didn't look bad. That it made perfect sense because prices and rents and income and earnings were in line. Now it's unthinkable. Well, real estate will be affected adversely and significantly so when rates go above 6. So you're going to see that effect in housing. This is what I'm predicting here. I haven't seen that elsewhere, but I expect it's going to be true. Wall Street Journal article continues, "The Fed is having a profoundly disruptive effect on real estate markets," said Mike Fratantoni, chief economist at the Mortgage Bankers Association. "Demand for housing has dropped pretty sharply, and we're beginning to see commercial real estate slow." So that's where you're going to see it first, is in commercial and industrial and retail and office, and then you'll see it in the housing sector. Sales of existing homes fell to their weakest pace in nearly 2 years in April, but with so many buyers competing for so few homes, prices continued to rise. Some would-be buyers are dropping out of the home search altogether, discouraged by both high prices and expensive borrowing costs. When the COVID-19 pandemic hit, the Fed quickly rolled out easy money policies meant to keep the economy afloat. So they artificially inject money, which is fine if you can sustain it, but it's not sustainable. It lasted a long time, but the hangover is coming. It lowered rates to near zero to spur lending. It also embarked on a spree of asset buying, announcing it would purchase an essentially unlimited supply of mortgage bonds. Prices on mortgage bonds climbed and yields fell. The resulting record low mortgage rates prompted a boom in refinancing. So again, if you want more of something, you lower the price. When you lower the price of loans, that means lower interest. You get more loans, more borrowing. And the result, the result is that you don't have the alternative. Once you get to a place where we are now, you don't have any alternative but to raise rates sharply, which is going to result in this recession. Now, the Fed is also winding down its purchase of mortgage-backed securities, which is also sending rates higher. The central bank bought about $13 billion in mortgage bonds in its most recent purchase, down from $35 billion last month, and more than $100 billion a month for most of 2021. So again, through 2021, $100 billion a month, and now they're down to $13 billion. The effect on that is higher interest rates. This is why we are seeing that while the Fed increased short-term rates by 1.5, the mortgage rate went up 2.7. The recent increase in mortgage rates seems unlikely to reverse soon. Fed Chairman Jerome Powell said that he expected another increase of 0.5 or 0.75 percentage point at the Fed's July meeting. Well, that's great, but it's still not going to do it. It's going to have to go higher, much higher. Some lenders are already quoting rates of 6% or more this week to the home buying public. Back to The Economist. Where I left off in The Economist was the housing market is slowing as rates rise in contrast to the late 2000s. It's not about to bring down the country's banks, which are strong. And at least the Fed does not face the predicament it did in the 1980s. Back then, inflation had been above 5% for 6.5 years, ladies and gentlemen. Think of what, if this inflation that's happening right now, think of your groceries, think of your gasoline, think of the fact that when you listen to the White House, they would have you believe they're going to get it under control soon. Back in the 1980s, and I remember this, inflation had been above 5% for 6.5 years. And to stop it in the 80s, interest rates went up to almost 20% interest. I remember distinctly in the early 1980s putting money in my checking account and getting 16 and 17% interest on my money. And interest rates, I remember Philly and I bought a house in 1980, and our interest rate on our loan was 13%. And we thought we had robbed the bank because we had friends who were getting loans for their houses at 15, 16, 17%. So that's what it took then. Now, it's not as bad this time because the inflation hasn't been entrenched for 6 or 7 years. The consuming public and the business public had not become accustomed and acclimated to just raising prices every single month and raising wages every single month. Nobody got used to that at this point. No one's gotten used to that. So it should be easier to dislodge it, but it's not going to be automatic. So The Economist, back then inflation had been above 5% for 6.5 years and it had to raise rates to nearly 20%, causing unemployment of almost 11%. Now, we have unemployment down in the threes and fours, depending on what numbers you look at. Imagine it at 11%. Today, inflation has been above the target for a little more than a year. It should be easier to purge. Okay. But no one really knows. They say, the Economist says inflation should be easier to purge this time. But again, tens of millions of people are going to make hundreds of millions of decisions, and that's how it's going to be decided. The natural thing to do if you're a consumer is to either buy more now before prices go up, depending on what you're buying, or slow your buying or stop your buying because prices are so high and you think they'll come down. Either way, that's bad. Now, if you're an employee, do you insist on a raise? Or do you change jobs to get one? And this perpetuates the problem and creates instability. So you see now people are beginning to leave jobs again. Nobody did this during the recession of 2007 through about 2013. Very few people changed jobs to get more. Now people are changing jobs to get more money. The Fed and the White House all have very limited tools and foggy visions, and the experts just don't know. The Economist. The trouble is that even a mild American recession would expose glaring fragilities. One is the commodity price crisis in much of the world, the result of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Countries from the Middle East to Asia are facing severe food shortages and soaring fuel bills. So we're seeing physical starvation begin to occur throughout the Middle East and Asia. The Eurozone is dealing with an especially sharp energy shock as it weans itself off of Russian oil and gas. Around the world, household incomes are collapsing in real terms. It's a real pay cut, the inflation. An American recession would land another blow on vulnerable parts of the global economy by curbing demand for their exports. Tighter monetary policy at the Fed and the resulting strength of the dollar would also compound what has already been the biggest sell-off in emerging market bonds since 1994. The International Monetary Fund says that about 60% of poor countries are suffering debt distress or are at a high risk of it. So this is now next going to bring us to the stock market. It's not just the rich. Almost 50% of the country is in the stock market directly or through your pensions or profit sharing plans, 401ks, IRAs, and other, you know, retirement vehicles. And prices and products are impacted by the stock market, even if you are in the other half of the country that doesn't own any stock. So on that subject, back to The Economist. Another weakness lies closer to home, on Wall Street. So far in 2022, the American stock market has fallen by 15%, comparable to the decline during the mild recession that started in 1991. The sell-off has been orderly, and America's banks are stuffed with capital, so we're not worried about a bank collapse. That isn't a problem right now. But after a decade of cheap money, no one can be sure how stratospheric asset prices will be affected by the combination of higher interest rates and the Fed-induced recession. Stocks are pricey relative to long-term profits. So that's the stock market. And next, we have the impact of the changes made following the 2008 market crash. A system of market-based lending has sprung up since the 2007 through 2009 recession that has yet to be severely tested. It includes investment funds that act like banks, vast derivative clearinghouses, and high-speed bond traders. If something goes wrong, the Fed will find it hard to bail out Wall Street yet again because it all will happen at the same time. It's going to force Main Street, at the same time it's forcing Main Street to cope with higher prices and job losses. So the bailout, the ones were too big to fail, and there were bailouts that happened, General Motors and so forth, there's no room for that this time. It's not a tool that they have in their toolkit. But now, finally, we get to the greatest weakness that we have in the country right now. It's our politics. In speaking with a lot of people, which is what I do a lot, I know you're not supposed to talk about politics with your friends. I do it all the time. And when I speak with people on the farther left and the farther right, and I mean, I have friends who are real, real, real Trump supporters and people who would have anybody but Trump, a stick of gum instead of Trump, as one of my friends says. In speaking with people on the further left and the further right, it's clear that neither extreme can hear the other because most people now get their information from sources that agree with them. People seek out sources that, and they listen to that and say, I'm getting the real story. This person really explains it well. And most of them say about the other sources, oh, I can't listen to that. No, I wouldn't listen to those people. Those people are evil, crazy, ignorant. So they don't listen to it. And I hear this from the far left and the far right, from people who don't think they're, by the way, far left or far right. They think they're objective and they're not. Because I know a lot of people in the middle, and I still believe 80% of the country is not far left or far right. I still believe that 80% of the people, when you really have a chance to listen to them, they're not far left and they're not far right, and they see both sides. So, interestingly, in this article about the economy, the Economist recognizes this. The Economist says, a final fragility is America's hyper-partisan politics. A recession will probably strike by the end of 2024, colliding with campaigning for the presidential election. If the economy is shrinking, the race for the White House in 2024 is likely to be even more toxic than expected. That's hard to believe, but I believe it. Politics could distort the government's response to a recession. Well, it distorts its response to everything. The Fed may be dragged into a venomous political battle after receiving handouts amounting to 26% of gross domestic product in the pandemic. Voters and businesses may expect the state to protect them from hardship this time too. In other words, the response during the 2020 recession was the government handed out money amounting to 26% of the gross domestic product. People might say, well, pass out more money. But the Republicans, who will probably control Congress, this is the Economist saying, the Republicans who will probably control Congress after the midterm elections in November, this November, would be most unlikely to spend money to stave off a downturn if that also risked saving President Joe Biden. So we have alleged perverse incentives on both sides. The Economist just here said Republicans would be unlikely to spend money to prevent a downturn if it also risks saving Joe Biden, or I suppose another Democratic candidate for president if Biden is not the Democratic nominee. Others say the Democrats want inflation this year to continue because it will postpone a recession until after the November 22 elections. And others say Republicans are secretly happy about inflation because it will increase the red wave in the 22 and maybe the 24 elections and are rooting for bad things. That's what some say. And here's the problem. All of these accusations against both Democratic and Republican leadership are probably true to some extent for some people, and at least they will be considered. So what we have is the usual name-calling and blaming and maneuvering for political advantage while the press reports on all of it sensationally. So the press is the willing accomplice of the politicians who are doing this. So what do we do? What is the best course of action? What should the government do? What should the government not do? The Economist has a view on it in this last section. The Economist. If America's economy does shrink in the next year or two, it could even alter the country's long-term direction. The best response to a downturn during which inflation remained high would be pro-growth reforms, such as lower tariffs and more competition. Instead, the recession may fuel populism and protectionism, and even could return Donald Trump to the presidency. Three of the past four recessions coincided with presidential elections or shortly preceded them. Each time, the party controlling the White House lost power. Measured by the technocratic yardstick of lost gross domestic product, the next recession could be mild, but not when judged by its impact on the emerging world, asset markets, and American politics. The last line of the Economist article, do not underestimate the perils that lie ahead. So, we need to brace ourselves. We need to stay calm. Don't panic. Stay informed. But look past the headlines. Set aside bias from anybody and think through your alternatives before selling, before buying, before changing jobs, or even before staying put. Staying put is a decision. Deciding to do nothing is a decision. We have to remain vigilant individually, in our lives, in our economics, in all of the things that we have to decide. We have to try to look past the headlines, try to look past the press, try to take in opposite points of view. I listen on a regular basis to the right-wing conservative Ben Shapiro and the left-wing liberal Pod Save America. It is valuable because what I find is I agree with both of them about 60%, and in the other 40%, I find both of them intentionally distorting and maybe unintentionally having bias that distorts. But by listening to both sides, I believe that I get a better picture. You should do that. Most important, decide what experts to listen to. It should not be the ones you see in legacy media or in social media or in political media. If you are going to rely on experts, rely on your own personal advisors. Consult with people you know and you trust, your own financial advisors, CPAs, business attorneys, if you have them. Consult even a one-hour consultation with someone who's doing this that you pay for rather than with someone who has something to sell you is worthwhile. It's worthwhile if you're trying to make decisions about what to do with assets. Just as the right place to find medical advice was never the government, but instead your own doctor during COVID. If you were listening to the government and the changing instructions and the confusion, if you asked your doctor about vaccinations and you listen to what your doctor said and you know that your doctor knows your personal condition and what you need, if you did that, you were in good shape. If you listened to the public media, you were probably more confused. So just as the right place to find medical advice was never the government, but instead it was your own doctor, avoid the cacophony of the news cycle and the sensationalism of the press and the toxicity of the social media. Talk instead to people you know, people you trust, individuals whose judgment you believe. And if your life has taught you that you have good instincts, if you actually are a good decision maker, meaning when you make choices in life, they tend to turn out the way you wanted them to, then rely on your intuitive insight after you've read and listened to everything and everyone you can. Look for as much information as you possibly can, and then ask yourself, how does this fit me? What do I need to do with my personal morals, ethics, my personal economics, my family situation, my health, my age, what passage of life I'm in? That will give you guidance as to what you need to do. Thank you so much for listening today, ladies and gentlemen. I really welcome your comments. I read every one of them. I appreciate you listening. My thanks to The Economist and to the Kiplinger Letter and to the Wall Street Journal, as well as all the other news sources that I watch and read and listen to, including ABC's This Week, NBC's Meet the Press, CBS's Face the Nation, reports on CNBC, MSNBC, CNN's State of the Union, and Fox News Sunday, and many, many others who contribute to both my confusion and ultimately to my understanding of the forces that create our world. My next show will be 3 weeks from today. I'll be off and back in 3 weeks. My guest is going to be Douglas Brinkley. Douglas Brinkley is a magnificent historian and author and a professor of history. And he's written a book called Cronkite, which, not surprisingly, is about Walter Cronkite, who was called the most trusted man in America. Now, can you imagine anyone getting that title now? He was regarded as the most trusted man in America, and I remember believing it and knowing most people believed it. Lyndon Johnson, as president of the United States, one day after Walter Cronkite did a negative report on the Vietnam conflict, said, "If I've lost Cronkite, I've lost the country." That's how influential Walter Cronkite was. Hard to picture today that any one commentator would have that much influence with the center of the country. You can find people on the fringe left and on the fringe right, but someone who had the command and the admiration of the vast majority of the country, you don't find that. I'll quote a couple of people with regard to this book, Cronkite. Dorothy Kearns Goodwin, one of my favorite historians, says about this book, Cronkite, by Douglas Brinkley, "This sweeping narrative of Walter Cronkite's life is irresistibly told, beautifully written, and deeply researched. It's hard to imagine a better match for the most trusted man in America than Douglas Brinkley, who has produced one trustworthy biography after another, each one commanding widespread respect and admiration, and this is one of the very best." I have one more quote I want to read from George Will. He is a commentator. He's a conservative, but he left the Republican Party over Donald Trump. So I regard him as center-right, but someone who I certainly would listen to and consider. George Will said of this book, Cronkite, by author Douglas Brinkley, "When the history of journalism is written in our era, it will be divided into two separate eras, BC and AC, before Walter Cronkite and after Walter Cronkite. And the great division here is that Walter had in spades what today is lacking in huge proportion, and that is trust. It's probably hard for Walter himself to fathom how the profession of journalism has declined in public trust, and I'm bound to say public esteem, since he left it. But the decline has been sharp and precipitous in a profession. As with currency, it's good to have a gold standard, and Walter is simply the gold standard of network, national, and shared news experience." So that's 3 weeks from today. That's Saturday, July 9, Saturday, July 9, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Ladies and gentlemen, please do use our Amazon, PayPal, and eBay links to support the fine programming here on TalkRadio1.com. My email address, steve@talkradio1.com. steve@talkradioone.com. Thank you so much for listening today, ladies and gentlemen. I am Stephen Spearer. throughout the country and around the world. This is TalkRadio1.com.